wonderful to be here in court. A very good friend of mine, Olive Brodie, who some of you probably know, is a poet who hails from here, and she lives in Downpatrick at the moment. And we're great friends. We've constantly talked about coming down here to read. So it is a great pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation. I'd like to start with the title poem from the Beachcombers report. And as was mentioned, I'm from Bermuda, which is a wonderful place to grow up. And one of the things that we have a special interest there is in The Tempest, Shakespeare's play. Because in 1609, there was a ship that was wrecked on Bermuda. Everyone survived and then went on to the New World in Jamestown. And the report of the shipwreck in Bermuda got back to London. Shakespeare heard about it and, well, according to rumor, but I'm pretty sure it's fact, then wrote The Tempest. So Prospero et al. Are huge figures in sort of Bermudian culture. And you only really need to know that because of the last line of this. The Beachcombers Report. The best place to hear the ocean in a shell is at a plain wooden desk in a bare room. Your eyes closed, knowing that if open, they would overlook the sound you're trying to remember. If you're on a beach, checking driftwood for texture, density, and weight, stop. Take the pieces to the fireside, and just before burning, smell them. Then rub your index finger along the grain. That's when you will value their assets best. When you pick up an imperfect green glass lobster pot float, carry it to a distant beach where such things do not exist and drop it, implausibly, beyond the high tide mark for locals to puzzle over. Barbie heads, canned torsos, cabbage patch fingers are best buried in identical suburban yards, forgotten, save for a vague feeling the writer might one day dig a bed for roses and imagine non-existent children. Should you retrieve the message from the bottle, hide the note in a library frequented by academics within a dry encyclopedia. Biographie générale, Francais de Trancis, Mère and Muir. Check from time to time if it has disappeared. Collect frayed orange nylon rope and pay someone who knits the going rate for a sackcloth and ashes jumper. Ideal for sitting in that bare room, listening to the ocean in a shell. And when all of this has been accomplished, burn the desk, scatter the driftwood cinders, throw all floats and doll parts back to the sea, unravel the jumper, and travel to Bermuda, primed to search for Prospero's book. Sticking with the sea, obviously, growing up on an island, the sea plays a huge part in your life, as I'm sure it does here as well. And this was written for my best friend's daughter, Erin, who's going off to university. So I sent her this the day before she left. Bobby surf. To understand everything about the swell, how on a given day, the seventh in the cycle provides the greatest chance to ride to shore if caught where the rip collides with the surge, where the wave pries a mouth wide and prepares to heave its traveled miles. To understand the moment of submission, when to dive in and up the crest in order to avoid a rapid tumble, flung skyward at the other side, pulling yards into the trough and humbled. To understand that we are aligned to leave behind horizons to the climbing wall, punched and turned through quarters, believing that the traveling momentum is such will be absorbed and pulled along. So someone watching oceans from a tower might raise herself a little on one elbow and to her partner whisper, "Dolphins." Save it all for the end when we interrupt. The next poem I'd like to read is After Wallace Stevens, from a very, very long poem, which you'll be thrilled to know that this is a very, very short part of that poem, and it's a version of that.
and again, view of Hondos in Bermuda.
It's called Sunrise. Empty ocean is best. Empty sky is best. Empty except for my singular shore, squatting low so the island's horizon curves on the eye. So the wrapping of surf around my feet is the touch to draw me out. Is the touch to draw me out by tides, and I swim and wallow in the dawn. Sticking with Bermuda still. This is a fairly long one, I'm afraid. It's called Cod Cakes and Kites. It was recently selected for BBC Poetry Please on a Sunday afternoon, which is it's rather weird experience listening to someone else read it. But it was lovely as well. So I was thrilled. The lady who requested it works with my mom, who's here tonight. We're on our way after this. We're down to Kenmare to visit some friends. So mom's here with me today, which is grand.
Wow.
A round of applause. Sorry, she explained the bruise. I just had a couple of blood tests, so I'm not actually an addict. Cod Cakes and Kites. After Monday, Thursday, she explained a wee bit about this before. Another thing about Bermuda that's fairly interesting is that we have a huge tradition of building kites on Good Friday. The original idea of flying a kite on Good Friday was to raise the cross of the original kite up into the sky, so to celebrate the resurrection. But we have our own very sort of colourful, beautiful kite now in Bermuda, and it's one of the great things about being in Bermuda on Good Friday is seeing thousands of these things in the sky. So you need to know that. And we also, at the same time as we're flying our kites, eat cod cakes. After Monday, Thursday supper, rinse the block of salted cod. Lower into a glass bowl filled with tepid water. Glance occasionally to check the process of desalination. When the water has clouded, drain and refill and re-soak. Ensure you rise once in the night to repeat this process. On Good Friday morning, drain into a colander. Flake the cod. Boil 6 of the freshest eggs, the same of potatoes. Now peel your 3 bananas and, slicing lengthways, spread over paper towel, allowing them to bleed moisture in the way of zucchini and aubergine. Season with pepper to temper the sugars. Gather the children, yours and the neighbors, choosing one who can be trusted to hold the Bermuda kite, completed days before, so the glue securing lozenges of multicolored tissues to the 8-spoke balsa frame and its intricate string web will have hardened to the point where the kite can have a good chance against air. Choose a patch of grass on which the dew has evaporated. Too many times I have witnessed tissue kites crash onto damp ground. Then, if the skies are clear, with only moderate winds, send the kite bearer down the garden, holding the kite at waist level, ready to be thrown skyward in one unrushed gesture. And make certain the knotted, torn sheet tail is coiled at the feet for its untangled rise. Check the tension is loose. Too taut a string will allow the kite no freedom to choose breeze and direction. Then, only on your signal, when your wetted finger dries, when all around you is still, should the release of the kite and the measured tug on the string and the running backward and the ascension and the cheering and the cheering and the cheering begin. When the kite is safely airborne, the string paid out and the rotor for control arranged, slip away. The potatoes and eggs will have cooled. Chop them roughly, adding dill, tarragon and flat leaf parsley. Handfuls and handfuls and handfuls. Sea salt to taste. Pepper. More pepper. Several good pinches of paprika. Then using a table fork, mash together with the cod and, yes, the bananas. Take a palmful of the mixture and shape into thick patties, dust each with plain flour. Place in a frying pan in which clarified butter sizzles. Brown to gold on both sides. Set aside and repeat until the last is done, the aromas just released and just wild. While they bake in a hot oven, I suggest 20 minutes. Go somewhere quiet to change into starched cottons. Add a simple tie or ribbon. Then open a window to a sweep of sky and children, and before you call them in to prepare your table, to partake, pause and look up to observe the light rich jeweled heads of hundreds of snakes swaying, 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 and be mesmerized. The next poem is a poet. There's a whole bunch of us sort of upper queens who went through MA writing programs and PhD English doctorate programs and writers group, then headed by Sinead Morrissey. There's a whole bunch of us who sort of came through that and are beginning to publish now. And one of those is Owen Walls, who will have a collection out next. This year from Sarin called The Salt Harvest. And we're very good friends, but Owen was looking over my manuscript that I was about to send out, which thank God I never did. And he said, you do use a lot of these sort of exotic words like oleander, tragopan. I thought about it, and I thought, well, you know, they are kind of the words that I grew up with. They are sort of my lexus. I wouldn't presume to say to you that you couldn't use potato or farl or something along those lines. So this is the poem that came out of that. Owen and I are still great friends. Yeah. I'm being told by an Irishman that I overuse the word oleander. If I agree, will you then permit me the use of avocado, mango, palmetto, sargasso, wahoo, pompano, longtail, loquat, mangrove, grotto, coral, and cajao? A word we gave the only indigenous creature to be found in our small island. Bougainvillea, pawpaw, cassava, barracuda, bermudiana. A tiny wild iris that is almost an adjective. Frangipani, amaryllis, hibiscus, kiskadee, skink, cereus, but most of all, cedar. Can I keep cedar? Because we have a strain of cedar that, like the cajao, is indigenous to our island, to which we have given the island's name. And this cedar, the most fragrant, the most buoyant of cedars, rich-grained and producing oils, is in danger. It was once the bronze bones of whalers and dinghies and prize-seeking sloops that outstripped what the world had to offer. And while it played its part in the fabric of flogging posts, gibbets, stocks, stakes, and pyres, when the blight of 46 destroyed almost all the trees, our island mourned. We still mourn and preserve what remains. Today, for example, it is a sin to burn cedar as firewood. Instead, we admire its antique nature, found in the ceiling beams and box pews of St. Peter's, the oldest Anglican church in the Western Hemisphere, in ceremonial chairs and boardroom tables, the banisters of grand staircases, dressers, sideboards, linen chests, captain's chests, window picture and bed frames, and a few surviving household items, candle holders, fruit bowls, butter paddles, drinking cups, lace bobbins, even doll's heads, knitting needles, crochet hooks, and toothpicks. And if you say it is cheapened by the knick-knack paperweights, letter openers, bookmarkers, shark oil barometers, coasters, puzzle cups, pens, pendants, and brooches that the island trades with tourists, I will answer that our craftsmen still value the grain and save from scrap the art of tradition. So, can I keep cedar? You see, wise men are surplus. We've allspice, oleander. Our cribs are cedar. There's a long section in the middle of this book, which I'm not going to read all of. It's called Survey. Some of this collection has to do with colonization and post-colonial and all that sort of stuff. It's a good trend. And this one in the middle, I thought, at the time I thought it sort of tied it all together, but it doesn't really. It's just a series of 13 poems. And each one starts off with an epigraph or a piece of writing that I found in a book that I thought was quite interesting. And perhaps they do have something to do with colonization. The first one is taken from a book called The History of the Pacification of the Empire During the Reign of Meiji, with illustrations by Sensei Otaku, and it's in 13 parts. So this is, I'm imagining what these illustrations might be called. The culling of doves on palace lawns, the bringing of children before butchered fawns, the ignoring and freeing of rabid hounds, the destruction of rare insect mounds, the mass importation of foreign trees, the harvest of fruits by amputees, the genetic enrichment of everyday species, the all-night burning of wheat and or maize, the slaughter of monkeys on holy days, the confiscation of sacrosanct functions, the deployment of forests for sinister functions, the strict regulation of natural laws, the continual recourse to probable cause. Second one. The epigraph, almost all the trees died, leaving a landscape of barren, contorted skeletons. The island finally experienced winter. Tell them the life-giving current has been seized by a corrupting influence. Tell them we will never again seek a house. They have surrendered their breeding grounds. Tell them oil slicks combust on eroded beaches, foreigners panic sell, and locals scoff in wonder. Tell them, even if unfamiliar with wealth, that insurers are barricading their doors, and banks will not pay out, and hotels are empty. Tell them, if you can, of your island's future. Then tell them I am here, at the bottom of the garden. I have been disturbed, and I am cold. Number seven. The moan of the sea on the breaker outside the bay, which is often heard from before rain, was likened to the roar of a hungry animal. We can't be denied, because this is a contract sealed on a wind-driven spit of rock, where the eyes and mouth of the cabin boy are shut against the sting of salt, and the sun above his bent head exists only on faith, and he believes and believes the beast approaching as a savior as much as a monster, and we moan and fall to our knees repentant and bleeding before who knows what and before what we feel. The cheery one. And the final one in that sequence. Again, it's something to do with Bermuda. There was a great diver called Terry Tucker who found this amazing treasure hoard, and the centerpiece of it was this beautiful emerald cross. Tucker's emerald-studded gold cross was stolen and replaced with a plastic replica. To this date, this astonishing example of shipwrecked treasure has not been recovered. When I brushed a thigh free of sand, the flesh had the lure of contraband, as in a gold and emerald Spanish cross, disturbed by a diver's hand. Now, there's a sense of loss, though that muscle toned and tanned, the warmth of which you'd understand if you brushed a thigh through the sand. In a cold, unproven land, where I've barely a command, disturbed by diver's hands, pushing me to cross and recross a bog of asphodel and moss, until I'm back where I began, recovered of that warmer land, where I brushed a thigh through the sand. I think a few Irish poems are called for. The title poem of the pamphlet is called Celtings, and it's based on Microsoft Windings, which is sort of a series, a strange sort of font of all various weird shapes. And when I saw this Celt at Low Tide, I thought I'd call it Celtings. So, Celtings. At low tide, I put the slip into boat's foot and landed my ass on the line, where green algae gives way to brown. Reduced to sea level view, I found exotic kelp frond calligraphies scrawled over every degree of harbor blue. Insular majuscules, Gothic minuscules, Carolinians, copper plates, bastard hands, the curlicues and cuneiforms of fancy shaping bywords for baptism and resurrection. Lines at Lapham Mill was written in County Cavan. Sadly, the B&B is now shut due to lack of business, but it was an amazing B&B right on River Erne. And I was staying there, I can't remember why, actually. But a friend of mine in London gave me a call, and she had recently been married, went on her honeymoon to New Zealand, came back, and her husband died almost immediately on their return to London. It was unbelievable. You know, if you wrote that, no one would believe it. But then she found out she was pregnant, so she gave me a call to say that she was. So it was kind of obviously very bittersweet moment. So this is written for her there. Lines at Lapham Mill. The shower has passed, but rain drops from the canopy to play the river like a drum. And I'm absorbed by the performance of a wayward beat falling on the page. The A in apple blossoms, and the B in beauty blooms, infecting with the bleed all well-meaning words. And just as well. For I would tell you simply, let the mill cat rest beside me, the dog transfixed by swans. I would write of an ancient weir broken for a race, of herds pastured for millennia, lapping waters that a heron scours, of the urn's remorseless measure over worn familial rocks, and of eddies they maintain for dedicated salmon. I would even reach and reference linnet's wings. But you have heard all this and are immune. Perhaps the fashion's passed as these spots in time diminish. Still, I'll take some pleasure from the seamless finish. A single note magnificat, climax to the great tympanic act, falls then fades in the quickening river. And now the page is parched. Old A's and B's that advocated venture have been stemmed. But you, attuned to perfect labors, prove dried blooms and blossoms will be shamed when shortly we will witness birth again. Talking just to Paul earlier, there was a McNeese conference a while back at McQueen's in 2008, and it was the millennium year of McNeese's birth, and quite rightly, everyone was rushing to celebrate it. We'd lived for about 4 seconds in the north of Ireland, but that was it's a good thing. So he was celebrated, but it was also Auden's centenary, and for various reasons, Mr. Auden was being ignored. So I thought, well, I'll write something in tribute. Tribute of him. And it's turned into something different. I'm not sure if it's a tribute, but it's certainly he was the inspiration for it. It's called Of the Vein. There, beyond the green chef lawn, the group who keep to shade and doff their boaters to the beauties, but fix an eye or eight on passers-by to warn them of a boundary. Says John to James, dates figs and plums, old chum. Look you there on deserts spread a picnic blanket. Here one adds, as one must, some rolling thunder. James to John. I hear, when it rains, Japanese ladies invert their parasols to catch chrysanthemums. One elder wanders off, as eventually one must. From underneath a willow tree, he leads his boy to bed and to obituaries. Matt to Tom. When birdwatching, I use opera glasses to spy the best-throated, don't you know? And so the code continues. here two dashes, there a dot. Passed down generations, or in lapel carnations, pinned by practiced hands. Matt to James to John to Tom, perhaps in Greek, with masks. Four marble peacocks move and shape their own mythologies. Here one adds, as one must, some desperate laughter. Tom to John to Matt to James. Perhaps en masse, they gesture. Let's raise a finger to detractors. Now, there beyond the green checked lawn, only parts survive. There, there now. A high brow, an elegant calf, a digit raised, displayed like this, and here, eye gesture. Or, as if there'd been a choice, a neck set in an angle, ripe for striking, muscles flexed by an adoring sculptor, veins plumped and fit for bursting, green, reclaimed. I say, I inherit the vein glorious. Sticking with that subject matter, perhaps, there's a few film poems in here. One of my great loves is film. And one of my, well, my favorite films is called Special Day. It's an Italian movie directed by Ettore Scola, starring Sofia Loren and Marcello Mastroianni, set in fascist Italy. And Hitler has come to Rome to visit Mussolini, and the tower block that Sofia Loren lives in empties completely. Everyone goes to watch this supposedly great event, except for Sofia Loren, who stays behind to prepare dinner for her family's return. The only other person that she discovers in the building is played by Marcello Mastroianni, and he plays a gay radio journalist who is about to be taken away, we presume, at the end of the movie, to be killed. But they meet up, and it becomes a special day. And I read this in memory of David Cato. I don't know if many know, but he was bludgeoned to death in Uganda as a result of government and newspaper campaigns to out homosexuals and thereby make them easy targets for death squads. On Mastroianni in a special day. The world, Marcello, has gone outside to witness Adolf hold hands with Benito. We have watched your booted and tasseled neighbors running to become the newsreel's throng. But I linger with you at a simple table, our backs to the State Department's view, and I will mirror you. Let us rest our chins once more on the back of our hands and sign. Like this, I will fall for you again. The face that pretends a curriculum vitae of macho bravado, betrayed by its history. The cheeks too quick to blush, the lips to tremble. Together, we define the obsessive verba for entrapment, which leads to the problem of filling our time. So, you grind beans for a last cup of coffee, lend me your three musketeers for escape, and we dance the rumble once more, as an act of defiance. Hold me tight and pilot me up to the tower block's roof, where we can display ourselves above all of Rome. Two men among immaculate avenues of boiled white sheets, we will move from back projected silhouettes to abandon ourselves in the leveling glare of sunlight where our secret must slip. Listen for the fall. But just this once, Marcello, I will be allowed to wrap you in cotton and steal you from harm, to smuggle you into an alien city, where we will be free to dance the latest craze with legions of courageous D'Artagnans. Start looking at my watch and completely forget when I started, so apologies. Two more. Islanded, which takes us back to Bermuda. Growing up on Bermuda is wonderful, but it's 22 miles long and a mile and a half wide. It can be a little bit confining, and
our big industry, of course, well, there's two actually. There's offshore banking, and there's tourists. And as lovely it is to have the money pouring in, there are times when it's even super just wants to do some property. Islanded. Why return to this avenue that opens to daylight on the beach, where I can pick mangoes and sink my feet, the one, the other, into the blue of familiar and unfamiliar tidal pools? Always from the horizon come polluted ranks of sails and liners and planes. If defined by the loss of degrees in these subtropics, still an invading force to rival great armadas, still vicious in their capacity. To guard the shore, I have sculpted a wall of heroes from wet sand, but have also watched them spent by tides. I have tried kisses and more as charms to save them all by indigenous canutes and calamites. Undaunted, I dispatch another man-o-war, its varicose tendrils to slip back undetected on the undercurrent and charge the ocean with the force of my convictions, defend, if it can, its isolation. I tear a ripe mango from its tree and splash in blue pools. I had my answer, and there was no evasion. The day tucks into history. Canvas after canvas sails close by before the pock-marked moon. And I'll end with a poem called Retreat, which was written for Ken and Jane. Ken, they're the parents of Aaron, who was off to university. I remember that long ago. Ken is a builder and recently just went through a huge scare with cancer, but has come out well on the other side. This is called Retreat. I built us a house from hand-cut limestone and stacked the blocks without mortar. A crude weight is the only chance they'll get. Our floorboards are of rare, untreated cedar, pegged and laid over bleached coral sand. I'll leave you to ponder the benefits of staining. I've forgone electricity, opting to hoard 200 boxes of slow-burning candles, 10 to a box. Wood for the oven is drying out against the beach wall. The oven is functional, the cooler exotically stocked. In the dining room is a painted table with only two chairs. Follow the logic. There's one queen size in the one bedroom. And propriety needs me to report there's no glass in the window frames. What you thought you saw through so clearly was, is, air. Say, ah. I'll bring my wardrobe if you care to dress for dinner. But there are no mirrors anywhere of any kind. No reflective surfaces of any sort. Like this, I will be fine. I've had the roof lime washed to the point where rainwater is sufficiently filtered to provide the softest supply for bubble baths. That lofty ambition complete, I've tried out some names. Cove Edge, Beachcomber's Hut, Blue Horizons. But at this time of life, and given our circumstance, let's live with a sign on the gate. Keep out. Renaissance.